Next up is Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Roland.
There's always money for war. There's always money for war. Oh, oh, oh. For the tanks and the bombs and the bullets and the guns. There's always money for war. No money for the doctors. No money for the nurses or the NHS. No money for the teachers. There's no money for the people on benefits, even if you're disabled. A young mother that's struggling to buy food, it don't matter if you're desperate. There's no money for you, there's just money for war. There's always money for war. Oh, oh, oh. For the tanks and the bombs and the bullets and the guns. There's always money for war. Well, you say the pot is empty.
Empty.
Well, you say there's nothing left.
Nothing left.
But these weapons are expensive. You got money for them. And when you blow up people's houses,
houses,
what you think they're gonna do?
Gonna do.
They come looking for salvation. They'll be looking at you. There's just money for war. There's always money for war. Oh, oh, oh. For the tanks and the bombs and the bullets and the guns. There's always money for war. Well, you take me to the arms fair.
Arms fair.
Try to show me that it's right.
That it's right.
All the people making profit. At the cost of people's lives. When you wanna fix a problem, gotta fix it at the cause. Maybe we stop building weapons. Maybe we'll stop starting wars.
Amen to that. And that was Beans and Toast. Obviously, Money for War. And we are gonna be talking about Money for War and the effect on militarism on our planet and everybody with Abby Martin. Good morning, Abby.
Thanks so much for having me, Paul.
And Abby, if you don't know, is a independent journalist, TV presenter, and activist. She helped found the citizen journalism website Media Roots and serves on the board of directors for the Media Freedom Foundation, which manages Project Censored. And you appeared in the documentary film way back when. Project Censored, the movie Ending the Reign of Junk Food News, and co-directed 99% the Occupy Wall Street collaborative film. So that was your first foray into documentary?
It was, yeah. Yeah.
And then, of course, you did the film on Gaza, The Empire Files, Gaza Fights for Freedom. And you're also an artist.
Yes.
Which is kind of a whole independent thing that I found, and you have a website there. Anyway, all this is on my website, kbo.fm, Wednesday Talk Radio. We're going to be specifically talking about your latest project, Earth's Greatest Enemy, which I fortunately saw a kind of world premiere, three different segments, sort of some more finished than others, at the Clinton Street Theater last month, which was great. And you've recently moved to Portland.
I did, yeah.
With your husband, Mike Preissner.
Yes.
Maybe just talk about that first.
Yeah, so we were in LA for 10 years. We were living in a very small apartment with two babies, and it became a lot, you know. Hollywood is a lot, and we work from home, so I just kept thinking, why are we here when we could be in moss and enchanted forests? And every time I'd come to Portland for the last 20 years, I've always fallen in love with it in a different way, and I know a lot of people here, and I kept getting drawn back to the moss, the wet, beautiful forests that you can just lose yourself in. I'm from the Bay Area, so that it kind of has a similar feel, and I love it, Paul. I haven't looked back. The odd thing is we did move on October 7th, so it's been kind it's been kind of tough to separate that, but
yeah, well, we will talk about that as we go along. But first of all, I always like to get a feeling from how my guests kind of got into what they're doing. So you know, I don't know, how did you like sort of come of age politically and get into journalism?
Yeah, so I grew up as a Clintonite Democrat with my family in a suburb called Pleasanton, California, about 20 minutes away from Oakland. And I was just totally ensconced and isolated in my own privilege. I mean, you know, just growing up kind of unaware, largely, of, you know, it was the 90s. It's like prime time, baby, you know, right before 9/11. So when 9/11 happened, it was a radicalizing moment for sure, of kind of taking stock of how could this happen? Why did it happen? What would compel someone to do this to our country? And then that compounded with the Iraq War propaganda drive. I mean, that unquestioning nationalism and patriotic fervor. And it was so rampant. I was at San Diego State as a freshman, and I just remember being surrounded by jocks in the lunch hall just cheering on the invasion of Iraq and feeling absolutely sick to my stomach. What the hell is going on? Why is the media doing this? You know, at first I was just like, Bush is responsible. And then why are the Democrats letting this happen? And then why is the media selling this? So it was a journey to my political awakening to understand this is an institution of empire, and that it's not just a partisan prism that, you know, we should belong into. We should understand this fully and have our ideological lens wrapped around this institution of imperialism, and, you know, which is an offshoot of capitalism, and war is driven by that.
And where did you take that knowledge and energy first?
Yeah, you know, at the time, it's so interesting to look back at this time 20 years ago, because there wasn't much alternative media out there. I'm sure, as you know, Paul, a lot that was online was like very conspiracy red-pilled stuff, like InfoWars and Alex Jones. And, you know, that's why I started Media Roots, because I kept going out there trying to agitate about the war. And, you know, there's only so much you can do on a street corner handing out leaflets. And so I thought, I need to create my own media to try to put this information out there. Otherwise, no one's going to hear it. And so realizing that media is really the foundation and the avenue in which I wanted to tell these stories and uplift the narratives of people who are being oppressed and marginalized and brutalized by the U.S., that's what drove my passion for media, citizen journalism, advocacy journalism. And it just took off from there. I remember I was at Occupy Wall Street in Oakland when the brutality happened in my backyard, and RT, Russia Today, some weird Russian network, was there taking the protests seriously while all mainstream media was ridiculing it. And I thought, look, I didn't know anything about RT. No one really cared at the time. RT existed to exploit the fissures in American society and exploit the divisions and lack of real reporting from the U.S. corporate media. And so I ended up working for them and as the liaison for Occupy. And then I moved to D.C. and had my own primetime show for 3 years at RT. This is about a decade before it became a national news scandal.
Right. and then before people got, well, I can't remember. I had Chris Hedges on, and he was forced off a whole bunch of platforms, I guess, because he was doing RT.
Yeah. I mean, Chris has the same story. I mean, his opposition to the Iraq War, and then just having less and less of avenues to try to tell these truths. And then RT gave him his show, full editorial freedom. You know, I mean, I even spoke out against Russia on RT. But yeah, I mean, of course, they succumbed to censorship, just like they were chomping at the bit to do. And then they memory holed and deleted all of my and Chris Hedges' entire archives of material. I mean, I had 600 episodes deleted from the internet.
That's what the whole issue was at the time.
It's too dangerous, Paul. Yeah. Too dangerous to our senses. We need to be infantilized too. We need to be treated like children. We can't see Russian propaganda because it's too dangerous. So they had to delete everything and, you know, and dictate to us what reality is. And now we have tech algorithms and you know, trying to curate what we see.
Now, of course, I was thinking as you're saying, talking about, and of course, you know that KBOO was a shining exception in the media landscape. But just thinking back of going back to the, you know, the first Gulf War, when Portland got the reputation of, quote, Little Beirut for being which I always thought was kind of silly. I mean, yeah, right. Beirut. If you look at what really goes on there, we're, you know, getting pepper sprayed and, you know, beaten up some people got beaten up by the police, and they brought their horse squadrons out after us. And et cetera. But yeah, comparisons are obviously far.
Well, Portland does have a good reputation with agitation.
Anyway, and how strongly KABU was covering that. And I was gone during 9/11. I was actually in Italy. And but I know KABU was strongly covering that for years. And of course, Occupy, KABU had a booth set up at Occupy in Portland for weeks, broadcasting live there. So yeah, go KABU, the mighty awesome. Boo. So that gets us up to RT. And then how did Empire Files come about?
So RT, funny enough, during the Crimea incursion, I felt really gross about how the network was covering it. It was reminiscent of the Iraq War, where I remember when the Iraq War invasion was happening, the media was, of course, completely uniform in selling the war. It showed people being basically telling us that they're going to be greeted with flowers and candies by Iraqi children. So to have that kind of flashback looking at the Crimea thing, where I was watching one thing with the U.S. press and then another thing at my own network where Russian soldiers were being greeted with flowers and candy. And I just thought, I need to differentiate my perspective and denounce just military aggression in general. And I felt really uncomfortable at that moment. So I went and told my boss. I said, look, I'm gonna say this statement on air. If you don't want me to, I'm going to quit today. And so he said, go for it. And so that's when I went and denounced Russia and denounced the network's coverage of what was happening. Wow. They made it untenable for me to continue.
Untenable.
They cut my staff. And so for the next 6 months to a year, it was very tough for me. I was basically doing a daily live show with like one other person. And so I ended up leaving. I had met Mike along the way. He was a frequent guest on RT. I was very impressed with him. He's an incredible anti-war organizer, Iraq war veteran. And so we started this project together.
I don't know if I mentioned that. It's your husband, Mike.
My husband, yeah. And so we started this project together that focused primarily on foreign policy, called the Empire Files. And it just took that basic truth that's right in front of our faces, but rarely acknowledged, that the United States is a global behemoth of military power with 1,000 bases around the world. What impact is that having? Why is that normalized? It's a grotesque abomination, and it's destroying the planet, and it's destroying, you know, millions of people's lives. And it's unnecessary, and it sucks all the resources out from everything else, you know. So we wanted to go around the world and be on the front lines of the struggles of communities that are impacted directly by U.S. foreign policy. So that's where the Empire Files arose from. We were selling the show to Telesur, which is a Latin American network, and then sanctions on Venezuela and Cuba impeded our ability to sell that show any longer. So
it's funny how your personal journalism seems to intersect right. with global geopolitics.
Yeah, right. I think it just speaks volumes about the capacity to tell these stories on you know, corporate media. I mean, you have to believe in those projects in order to ascend in corporate media. And so that's why I went to these other kind of networks to try to navigate and circumvent that. But yeah, for about 5 years now, we've been fully independent, funded by small donors, and we made Gaza Fights for Freedom in 2019. And then we've been working now, Paul, for the last 3 years on this film, Earth's Greatest Enemy, earthsgreatestenemy.com.
And just before we jumped into that, yeah. immediately, is your main platform then YouTube for seeing your podcasts and your videos?
Sadly, yes. I mean, we're all kind of victims to the tech, you know, tech world, where every day we're like, oh, is our YouTube channel still going to be up today? Well, hopefully it is, because that's all we got right now. Yeah, unfortunately, that's where it's at. But YouTube, SoundCloud, we do our podcast there. And yeah, that's primarily where our videos are hosted.
So I was thinking you were talking about getting out to see, you know, the effect of U.S. empire mm-hmm. around the world. And one of the main, I guess there are three segments you showed at the Clinton Street, was from Okinawa, where there's this grotesque filling in this beautiful, incredibly beautiful marine ecosystem to extend this base out. It's it's bad enough that our presence is everywhere, let alone the kind of destruction that goes along with it. But so did you first go to Okinawa with like Empire Files before?
Well, Okinawa is an interesting story because that's kind of what helped further radicalized me when I was a freshman in college reading Chalmers Johnson's book Blowback. And there's a chapter in there about Okinawa specifically. And Chalmers Johnson was a CIA, and you know, he's a total insider. And he was radicalized by Okinawa. He was radicalized by the complete impunity that our military had to just rape and pillage Okinawa, quite literally. The status of forces agreement there is just a holdover from World War II, and it's grotesque. And
in Japan, of course.
In Japan, yeah. And so it's horrifying. I mean, we have 32 military bases on an island the size of Rhode Island, and we're building more. We're building more, Paul, and these people have been out there for 20-plus years straight. I mean, when I say straight, I mean every day. There's civil disobedience of people literally throwing their bodies in the gears in front of these trucks. There's trucks landfilling the mountains and just pouring all the dirt into the Ora Bay to build another Marine base. And it's absolutely just an exercise of just complete absurdity and destruction.
I want to get back to the amazing scenes. I mean, you know, direct action got into my blood, and I just love watching good, you know, I say effective in the sense that they're well planned out, well executed, whether or not they, you know, ultimately achieve their biggest objective. You know, that's always a difficult one, but I always really appreciate good direct actions. And there are some really powerful scenes of you all out on the water, and you and the other people, especially the Japanese, over and over for years, putting their lives on the line. But anyway, we'll get into that. But I kind of want to step back. So how the connection between environmental destruction and especially the climate crisis and militarism, how did that come across here?
I think it was, you know, Mike and I share a passion for exposing how imperialism shapes our world. And when we had our first child in 2020, it kind of shifted over to what kind of world are we leaving behind? You know, I was always kind of averse to watching climate change documentaries because I didn't want to really face head on how bad it is. But my friend Dar Jamail wrote The End of Ice, an incredible book about climate change. And I had to read that. And when I did, I just was so mad, Paul. I was so pissed. And it just all kind of coalesced. I mean, the fact that this is happening, and we're not dealing with it. You know, we're just full steam ahead in the way that we're continuing our lives, and the fact that the military is this huge contributor to climate change and environmental destruction, and no one's addressing it. And you know, I kept hearing that statistic, like the U.S. military is a larger polluter than any other force on the planet. The U.S. military is a larger emitter than 140 countries. And so, like we were talking before, there was only like piecemeal articles, maybe a couple academic studies about this, but no one has really put together a cumulative thesis that exposes the totality, not just emissions, the totality of everything. And so Mike and I realized, like, this is what we want to do. We want to combine our passions with our profound climate anxiety that has been spawned by having a child and realizing we need to do everything that we can to change
just
this.
We don't have Mike here to speak for himself. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you want to speak for him, but it just my curiosity has piqued. I asked you about how you came of age. Was Mike radicalized in Iraq as a?
I think it took a while for him because he was so in the thick of it. And when you're there, you have to really justify why you're there, you know, to not lose it. And I think that when he got back, he kind of started unpacking his experience and relating it to the Iraqi people. There's a famous testimony of him at Winter Soldier where he's just like, I was the terrorist. You know, I saw my sister in the little girl of the house that I was ordered to go and raid. And it's bone chilling, and it's really moving, and he's really atoned for what, I mean, he was a kid. That's what's so crazy. I look back at these photos of him being recruited. He the bleach spike tip hair, the puka shell necklace, he looked like he was like 15 years old, and he's being recruited by an army officer in Florida. And he was 17 when he officially joined. That's how young these kids are. And he joined a month before 9/11. And the you know, the recruiter's just like, oh, even if we go to war, you're just going to be sitting at a computer in Germany. And
the
then there he is.
Before.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
isn't that amazing? So yeah, he's really, I mean, he just dedicates his life now to helping people get out. You don't have to go. And even if you're in, you can get out. And there's ways to do it. And so he organizes with About Face here in Portland, and Eyes Left is his project that tries to reach out to young military, not even young, I mean anyone who's in the military that is uncomfortable with what the military is asking them to do.
So I should reintroduce the program, which is Wednesday Talk Radio, and myself, I'm the host, Paul Roland, every week. And my guest today is Abby Martin, who has a new project out, coming out probably this fall sometime. Well, hopefully mm-hmm. the sooner the better, because yeah. It's really powerful from what I saw. Anyway, and also does Empire Files on YouTube and SoundCloud, both a video and a podcast, and also did 99% the Occupy Wall Street collaborative film, and a bunch of stuff has collaborated with Project Censored, and is now here in Portland and in our studios. So great to have a live guest in the studios, happening very infrequently these days. Hopefully we'll turn that around and start happening more and more. So this is a listener call-in show, too, and the number to call is 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187, to get on the air with me and Abby. And I'm just going to pull up my Facebook page so I can communicate with my my board operator, but you all don't have to know that, do you? the footage, let's get back to what we were talking about just before, the Okinawa,
yeah,
and the massive U.S. military presence there in this new base that they're constructing. And of course, they have to destroy a marine ecosystem and put this huge landfill out into the bay, I guess, there. What I wanted to get into was how impressed I was both with that and the scene of you at the arms fair, right? And just the chutzpah that I used to feel as a younger person, and unfortunately, probably like many of you listening, go ahead, admit it, but we can do something about it still. We can. We're not over the hill yet, but that youthful feeling of being able to take on the world and challenge and fight power and speak truth to power, and which we're doing here, which is good and important. But the direct action, and you know, you obviously took the attitude of direct action into your documentary filmmaking and other work, I assume. And so yeah, just talk about that. Just maybe the entry point might be, so you seem to be able to get into places like a ship in the Pacific?
Right.
Well, these military affairs, I guess you can get into, but you seem to be able to work your way in and then be in a position to ask powerful people uncomfortable questions. So, you know, did that take time to develop that kind of boldness, or is that something you always kind of had?
I've always been totally fearless at a detriment to an extent, but I go balls to the wall, Paul. And you know, when I was in DC, I remember I was in the halls of Congress, and I remember asking Rand Paul something, and it was not one of these pre-approved, pre-scheduled press conferences. And a couple days later, I got a phone call from the congressional press office saying, you know, we're going to charge you with arrest and stalking of a congressman because you asked this, you know, unfiltered question. And I thought, oh, this is the way this operates. And then I was basically brought into this room with all the bureau chiefs of all these corporate media stations just saying, like, this is not the way we operate. We have to do this and that. And I was just like, this is crazy. So I've always been out there. I mean, as an activist, I do not care, and I don't feel like you need to go and work with the people that you're trying to question and work with the entities that you're trying to hold to account. But what's funny about this film is, you know, Gaza Fights for Freedom, it was just me editing footage from journalists in Gaza, and I wasn't in the film, I just narrated it. But this one, I really wanted to be out there agitating these people who are just completely protected and shrouded with impunity and never encounter anyone questioning what they do. And it's amazing. I mean, these generals are so
pampered. Which is why you're able to get those, because they think that nobody's going to question them.
They think no one's going to question. These generals are so pampered. They probably have personal drivers, personal chefs. They never encounter actual members of the public talking to them about anything. And so they're just absolutely floored. And, you know, as secretive and insular as the military is, they're also just a kind of a bumbling bureaucratic nightmare. And so even though I'm this out there journalist who's very obvious, you know, it's a very obvious what my agenda is, I still was able to slip through, especially with the RIMPAC warship in the biggest war games in the world in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. I mean, they helicoptered me out there and dropped me on this aircraft carrier. And I was just there with like five other actual defense reporters. And I was just thinking to myself, how is it possible that you didn't just Google these people who are flying to do this? But once you're out there, they can't do anything except throw you in the ocean. So, you know, they had to placate me. And the funny answer that a lot of them give is just like, you know, they give their stock answers of military jargon and try to wash away what the pointed questions. But then they all just say, like, isn't it great that we have freedom of the press? Isn't that great that people like you can come and ask us these horrible questions? And we tolerate those people like you. And I got that answer quite a few times, which is pretty comical.
Well, we do have a couple callers. So let's just go straight to our first caller, which is Santiago. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for having this episode, Paul, and thank you, Abby, for being on. I've watched the Empire Files. I think you do a lot of great work and ask all the right questions that we need to be asking, so I appreciate you. I guess, and I don't know, I tuned in kind of late, so I don't know if I missed anything, but, you know, like, I guess one of my questions I would have for you is, like, how have you found ways to shake... You know, because I feel like a lot of the, you know, the reason why the U.S. military can do what it does is because people have just grown complacent with, you know, bipartisan politics and understanding that, you know, it's like we just have to do this because this is just how it's done. And we have a lot of people, even well-meaning people, who say this all the time. And the truth of the matter is that we've got to break out of this thinking. If we, you know, you can't have a new direction if you don't try new things. And so I guess one of my questions I'd ask is, like, what did you find was effective for you to break out? Because you said you were a Clintonite Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
And how did you, what was it for you that really helped to shatter that bubble around, like, bipartisan thinking and lesser of two evils thinking?
I mean, I think, honestly, if I could pinpoint one moment, it was Nancy Pelosi saying impeachment was off the table for George W. Bush when Dennis Kucinich introduced those articles of impeachment. And I was so irate. And I just, that's when I knew that the bipartisan foreign policy consensus was an existential threat to humanity. And, you know, the more people you meet that are impacted by this, I mean, the thing is, it's like, yes, militarism is so ingrained in our society. It's at every sporting event. It's, you know, everyone knows a veteran or everyone knows an active duty person. But I think that, you know, it goes back to that consciousness and the integration that Martin Luther King talked about, which is you cannot even look at economics. You can't look at any social problem without that understanding of how militarism fits into that. And I mean, every year we're spending such an astronomical amount on our military, and it's just sucking away the life force of this country.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, absolutely. Just in the last year, I think the increase in the military budget was more than Russia's entire military budget, just the increase last year. So I think just that awareness should tell, and no one will agree with that. I mean, it's totally outlandish when you really break down the numbers, and as I'm about to get into, just the sheer amount of vehicles, it's cartoonishly evil and insane. And I think that as we kind of go on this collision course with climate change and environmental degradation, I think it's going to come to a head where we're all going to have to confront the nature of our country, what empire is costing us, and imperiling the planet. And it's just going to take public consciousness. I mean, that's why we're doing this documentary, because when I bring up just the word empire, people are like, are you talking about Star Wars? It's like, no, dude, this is us.
Right.
We are empire babies. Wake up. But I mean, I every day I ask, how the hell is it that more people are not just out, totally outraged at just the existence of this war machine?
Well, if you have one last quick question or comment, and then we got another caller.
Okay, and then my last question, and then I'll go. So and this kind of leads into what you were just saying. So understanding what's at stake, when you bring up that the Democratic Party is just a nicer right-wing party than the Republicans, because I tell people, like, I don't care if you vote for Biden, but you need to vote with both eyes open. And a lot of people take that as like, well, when you say that, you're poisoning the well, because even if Joe Biden has done all these horrible things that have led us up to this moment that we're at now, he's still better than Trump. How would you explain to somebody, like, not necessarily like, don't, if you want to vote for Biden, do it. But, like, how would you talk to them about voting with both eyes open?
I mean, yeah, I think Biden is the perfect example of someone who really is indistinguishable from Trump on so many issues. I mean, just the fact that he's facilitated and overseen the genocide in Gaza. I can't vote for someone who's overseen genocide. But I think that, you know, Biden, with his past of being anti-abortion, he's opened more drilling permits than even Trump has. So at this point, I understand why people are scared of Trump, but at this point, I cannot in good conscience cast a vote for someone who is a genocidal maniac, who is, you know, basically killing, you know, overseeing the starvation of a million kids. And you know, I had a gun to my head for 20 years, basically saying, if you don't vote for Democrats, you're going to lose your right to abortion. And look what happened. So I think that this kind of fear-mongering is not working anymore to make us join the two-party system and just fall victim to it. And I think that people are waking up more and more, especially young people, just seeing that the Democrats are not going to save us. In fact, they're staving off the inevitability of a fascist president. And the more that we buy into the system, the less organizing on the ground will happen to actually provide a future that is sustainable for us.
Thank you, Santiago.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And so we do have a Boris up next, but I would like to invite other people to call in at 503-231-8187. And after Boris, I want to get deeper into the film itself, which is coming out in a few months, hopefully. And we got Boris up next. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Well, hello, Abby. And wow, I am... I'm so glad to hear that you enjoy this part of the world as much as I do. And I'm so happy to be able to talk to you now. I saw you and your family out in the streets of Portland here a few weeks ago, and I regretted after the fact that I didn't take the time to come up to you and thank you in person.
But here you are now.
That's very sweet, what, Boris. Thank you.
Exactly why I'm calling. So I'm going to take the opportunity now to say that I've been watching you since the early days of RT, and I appreciate and respect everything that I've seen you do.
Thank you.
I'm so happy to be able to tell you that now. Paul brought up something that is a perfect segue to what I wanted to point out, and that is your style of interview. I was really taken with it the first time I saw you interview someone. And what I'm referring to is the fact that you're relentless. You don't ask a question, and then when the person dodges the question or pretends like they didn't even hear the question, you don't go on to the next question. You hang on and keep pressing the point. And I've seen you actually break someone down and get them to admit the truth with that style. And I was talking to another person once about, you know, so-called progressive investigative journalists, and he was touting, you know, another so-called investigative journalist. And I said, that person can't hold a candle to Abby Martin. And he stopped and he said, Well, you got me there. So my question for you is, do you think the reason for this typical approach to investigative journalism is that there's a shortness of time, so rather than press the question, they just move on to the next? Or do you think it's just an excuse for them to say, look, I ask hard questions, when in fact they don't, because they don't demand an answer to the question?
Right.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, Boris, thank you very much for all your kind words, and I hope that the next time you see me out, you can come up, feel free. But yeah, I mean, I see this all the time, which is people sitting down with very, very powerful people and just totally just kissing their feet, and maybe they'll throw in one critical thing and then they just get steamrolled and just don't follow up because they want access. That's what it's about. It's about the continual access to power. And so if you risk that, you could be shut out forever. And so I've seen this time and again where people just go along to get along. It's like, even if they do have good ideas and beliefs, they just kind of fold into them because they want, hey, once you get that, it's a drug. It's a drug. And you can see yourself ascend in the ranks of these institutions. But I don't play that way. And I think that anyone who's really trying to speak truth to power does not either.
Well, thanks for calling, Boris. And before we get to our next caller and other callers at 503-231-8187, don't wait till 5 till 9 o'clock, please. Let's talk a little bit about more about this film. I know you want to talk about there's two questions. I know you, one question I know you want to talk about, and I also have another thing, is this idea of you started to get into about, you know, what is the overall picture of the military's, quote, carbon footprint. I hate that term. Their contribution to the climate apocalypse, which is upon us, and the idea that it's really hard to calculate. So why is it so hard to calculate the military's carbon emissions and even perhaps use of fossil fuels?
Yeah, this has been a big one, Paul, is a doozy, because the military is the biggest consumer and purchaser of fossil fuels on the planet, but they don't count anything and they don't calculate their emissions. So even if you just take that, which is really the tip of the iceberg, which is I'm going to explain, independent scientists and academics have had to quantify that themselves. So they've had to calculate the emissions just based on oil purchases from the U.S. military, because, look, under the banner of national security, you can anonymize everything that you do. And that's what gives the military this special kind of access to just go and plow through endangered forests and habitats and ecosystems, too, is the national security, national security. So if you're just taking those oil purchases, which is bigger than any other institution, that means that the Pentagon is a bigger annual emitter of CO2 than 140 countries. Like I said, that scratches the surface, but let's just think about that statistic alone, which is countries usually have infrastructure, transportation, factories, housing, all of these things that make sense, right? Massive amounts of people. The Pentagon exists as no other reason other than just a huge, massive infrastructure of militarism. So that's kind of gross, right? That matches 140 countries, and it serves no purpose whatsoever other than imposing violence. But when you look at why is it that it is this huge polluter or emitter than 140 countries, it's because of the massive amount of vehicles that we have. So, you know, we have a bigger armada of ships and land vehicles than any other country in the world. When you hear that the U.S. military is bigger than the next 9 or 10 countries combined, that we're usually talking about in terms of how much we spend. But if you look at how many vehicles we have, it's bigger than like the next 7 countries combined. If you just look at aircraft alone, like a B-52 bomber, it's the most useless, insane aircraft ever, because it would take the average American driver 100 years of driving to match one single flight mission of a B-52 bomber. And this really brings us to that individualized notion of that it's up to us, the onus is on us to solve climate change and to recycle and do this and that. And look, I do my part. I would go nuts if I didn't. But when you match it to what the scale and scope of the military is doing on a daily basis, it's laughable. It's disgusting. And you know, a B-52 bomber uses diesel fuel. There's 80 of these planes flying around at any given time, and they are needlessly flying around because it's just about mission readiness. It's about power projection. So then you go into, I mean, the ships, it just goes on and on and on. All of the bunker fuel that's used outside of the U.S. territorial waters, in international waters, none of that can be counted, Paul. None of that has to be counted. And all of the naval arsenal uses bunker fuels. This is 1,000 times dirtier than diesel. So we're talking about tens of thousands of active vessels, of vehicles that are just flying around, projecting themselves needlessly, dumping all of this stuff into the ocean, into the air. But beyond vehicles, ships, and aircraft, I mean, that it's impossible to quantify because of the bunker fuel, because they don't have to count that. And then also beyond that, all the bases around the world, the infrastructure, the maintenance on the 1,000 bases, they don't have to count any of that.
Cement, metal.
Oh my God. And then, and then we're talking about raw extraction of resources, the shipping of the weapons, the shipping of the materials, all of the energy put forward to maintain those. All the supply chain emissions are completely unquantifiable.
That's why nobody wants to think about this, because it's so goddamn vast.
It's so big. And then if we're not even talking about war, we're talking about like literally just maintenance. Maintenance.
And then I want to get into this. For some reason, the thing that sticks into my mind most, in addition to the images of the glaciers melting with the Dardumel and the action at Okinawa, the destruction of the munitions.
Yeah.
Well, we'll talk about that, but let's get to...
Well, let me finish this point really quickly, because this is really important about why we don't even incorporate this into our consciousness, is because back during the Kyoto Treaty, the first international climate treaty in 1997, the U.S. military lobbied for exemption. So all of these international climate pledges that we're told are going to save us, net zero, that we've been browbeaten about, oh, we're all going to do our part and we're all going to just plant trees and then we're going to offshoot the carbon, da-da-da-da-da. None of the military's emission is counted in these pledges because of the U.S. military. And because the U.S. military lobbied for exemption, it was cemented in stone from the first climate treaty on, and every other country's military followed suit. And so all of these international climate treaties are complete farces because they don't address the elephant in the room.
Thank you. That bears repeating over and over again. Well, let's go to our next caller. Elliot, please make it short and sweet.
Yes, well, I have a criticism which would apply equally to Chris Hedges or Tom Hartman, you know, not just to you, but... The basic problem in the left is that basically you're only interested in, you know, pointing out the problems, and the only way we will ever have any solution to the problems is to have what in computer science they call an effective procedure, a determinate procedure for producing reform or progressive supermajority in the legislative and executive branches. And you just don't face up to the fact that you've got to come up with better ideas and more unified ideas for activating and unifying and organizing people, including some people on the Trump side who are necessary for a supermajority. And that's my comment.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with reaching out to Trump people. I think that this movie appeals to everyone, because everyone, even if you're not a believer in climate change, no one wants the oceans to be polluted and poisoned. And so I think that this really can transcend political partisanship, and that's what I'm intending to do. But to answer your question more pointedly, I think that you're asking too much of us. I think that, you know, journalists like myself and Chris Hedges, it's not up to us to point out the problem and then also to present a unified, cohesive solution. I mean, we're not gods. I don't know exactly what the solution is other than the system that we're living under is killing us and killing the planet. And so what I can only use my passion and talent and my expertise to do what I'm doing. And we can't organize anything unless people know what the hell is going on. But thank you very much.
Well, let's go to, let's wait on Garrett, because this brings up something I did want to talk to you about. I've, in my own probably somewhat unfocused and not completely coherent way, I've brought up repeatedly this very issue, which is, you need to have some traction point, some way of engaging the power. You have to, if you want to enter the game of, quote, solutions, which I think is ridiculous, or of, you know, some sort of arena of struggle, some sort of mode of struggle that you think has some capability of influencing the course of events that are going so disastrously, that there have been, you know, there have been, most of the ones that I know of have been Marxist-influenced revolutionary movements that, you know, have either have overthrown regimes and gained state power or, you know, whatever, or a share of state power of influence things. You know, the Green Movement had its moment, you know, and had some influence mostly in Europe at one time. It never really gained the kind of, you know, the force let's just call it what it is, the workers or proletarian, organized workers, proletarian mass movements at one time in history were able to gain, you know, Russia, Cuba, Vietnam, other places, you know, and we don't have anywhere near the days it would take to actually talk about how it all went, et cetera. And there really hasn't been anything kind of to, quote, take that place of those kind of large-scale mass movements. You know, the anti-globalization movement of the 90s was very interesting. Of course, 9/11 kind of nipped that in the bud. You know, anyway, people probably have other better ideas than I do on this. But there are, you know, some of the more powerful, most coherent groups are still some of the, you know, Marxist influenced groups. And I just want to mention that I don't belong to any particular organization or parties myself. I was an Earth Firster, which is kind of a different beast. But anyway, I know this is a long-winded way of getting into saying that there are still revolutionary groups, and, you know, whether you agree with their ideology or whether you think they're effective, one of them, the Party for Socialism and Liberation, who actually one of the sponsors of that film, and I don't know that much about them. I've been, you know, had to do with a lot of different groups, socialist, communist groups over the years, because they're often the ones who are there with you on the front lines, organizing direct actions or being part of them or whatever. Anyway, so talk a little bit. I know your husband Mike is a member of that. Say something about the Party for Socialism and Liberation.
Yeah,
and my general point, if you kind of
yeah, no, I like your point, and I think that yeah, I mean, there are plenty of groups that are agitating and organizing with the capacities that we do have, and I think that we've seen the failure of electoralism, the limitations of electoralism, especially in the wake of the Bernie Sanders movement, this kind of gross disillusionment and disenfranchisement with millions of young people, and I think
who were turned on to the idea of socialism.
Right, exactly. And it really shifted the Overton window in a good way, but now we're kind of left rudderless. Like, who do we organize behind? Where do we go? And we don't really have a leader. But these groups exist. The PSL, I've been a strong ally to for the last 10 years because I feel like their Marxist-Leninism an analysis to synthesize how imperialism is an offshoot of capitalism. And it helped me with my fundamental understanding, because I came from a more anarchist leaning, you know,
me too.
origin of my political awakening. I hated, I just didn't want to be in a camp. I thought I was not left or the right. And so they kind of helped orient me and understand that actually I am a socialist and actually capitalism is the problem. And I think they're a great party and everyone in it is really good politically, as far as I know. But my husband's been a longtime card-carrying member, and I do think that they do very good work, especially on foreign policy.
Well, let's go to, we got a couple callers on stack. Probably won't have time for any more. Let's hear what Garrett has to say. Make it as quick as you can. Thank you.
Hey there. Thanks so much for having this show. And I just want to ask, point blank, you know, we live in a world where swirling with so much communication, you know, you mentioned it, tech and all these things. How do you cut through the noise, and how do you, like, A, cut through the noise, and B, like, how do you have those conversations with people that may even not want to listen to you? You know, they hear three words and they turn it off. How do we start having these conversations more, get to the rallying points?
I mean, whether someone's conservative or liberal, I mean, liberals can even be more difficult to talk to than conservatives, frankly. But I try to just open it up with things that anyone can agree with and anyone cares about. Like I said, I mean, my conservative friends, they really are upset about when I tell them aspects of the environmental destruction that the military does. So even though they may disagree with me on certain aspects of this film, like that's still reachable to them in that way. When it comes to the Palestine situation, you know, my dad leans more conservative, but he's outraged at just the amount of money and the kids dying. I mean, everyone can relate around the fact that just 13,000 kids being killed is just horrific. Everyone, you know, can relate to that. So I think trying to bring it back to these relatable, unifying points, and when you talk about just the enormous amount of waste and money being spent, and the fact that we're treated like children, that, you know, we're told that we can't talk to other world leaders, that we have to sanction other countries that do differently. I think that those are really interesting points that everyone can start a conversation around. But if you're talking about just someone sitting in a coffee shop, I mean, you know, it's hard because we're all kind of atomized in this society. But, it's always just interesting to just bring up things and just see where people's heads are at. But I would encourage everyone to just get out of their own way and just start the conversation and just see where it goes. You know, you can't win them all, but if we don't try, we're not going to win anything.
Thank you, Garrett. And before we got to move on, because I did want to talk about like where the film is at.
Yeah, yeah.
And and I'll give you a chance to do that, and then let Cherry get in, who's been waiting patiently in a couple minutes. So, well, what's going on with the film?
Yeah. So I mentioned military missions. That's obviously a huge part of it, but really this is the tip of the iceberg, because we get into habitat destruction, we get into nuclear waste, we go to Guam, Okinawa, Alaska, and Hawaii. So it's that kind of territorial, oceanic buildup of the empire that's agitating war against China and amassing all of its power to plan for that. And so while you have all these world powers coalescing to try to organize war, they should be organizing to fight the actual existential threat that the world is facing, which is climate change. So, you know, I'm inside these climate conferences. I'm outside the climate conferences with the organizers on the ground. I'm with the indigenous communities that are fighting on the front lines. It's going to be an incredible film, and, you know, weaving throughout the film is obviously the personal narrative of me and my husband having kids and navigating how the hell are we going to do this and live in a world like this, and then the bizarre nature of just militarism and how embedded it is in our society and how unquestioning this aspect of empire is. So it's going to be great, but yeah, there's so much more too. That's what we realized too when we started the investigation. We're like, this goes so much more beyond climate emissions. And so the totality and proving the thesis of how the U.S. military is Earth's greatest enemy, in fact, has been an enormous undertaking, but we're very excited to put it out there. And like you said, Paul, the issue couldn't be more urgent.
Indeed. Well, let's go to Cherry. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Paul, and hi. Thank you for your wonderful guest. For years, I've said nothing is more damaging to the environment than war. Nothing. Mm-hmm. Point two, the former editor of Harper's Magazine, Roger Hodge, wrote in the Mendacity of Hope that the logic of empire is domination and the logic of war is killing.
Mm-hmm.
It is folly to pretend otherwise. I think it is brilliant in its clarity, its simplicity, and its truth. Third quick point. I voted for years. I have a terrible record of electing a president for somebody other than the two major parties. And I've made it very clear and outspoken about it. And I've had a lot of criticism and et cetera. And my point for mentioning that is, when you vote for the lesser of two evils, you always get evils. So how do we ever change anything if we are constantly told we have to do that? How do we ever change anything?
Thank you, Cherry. And I want to add on to that, because we're just about out of time. If you could maybe mention, are you still fundraising for the film? What do you have a timeline, or is that like a bad question?
No, that's a good question. Thank you for saying that. And Cherry, I couldn't agree more with you, and I think that you said it all. I don't even think I need to comment on that. Yes, we're still fundraising for the film. We have quite a bit of post-production to do, the editing, our editor, and also just animation and graphics and audio. But we're 60 minutes in, and we got a little ways to go. So if anyone's interested, if anyone has the capability, please reach out to us, earthsgreatestenemy.com, earthsgreatestenemy.com, exactly how it sounds. Check it out. The trailer's on there. We had a special sneak peek screening in Portland a couple weeks ago. Great feedback, and we're super stoked to get out there this year at some point.
This year.
Yeah.
Right on. Well, we're definitely looking forward to it. Any other sort of sneak peek screenings you think are becoming?
No, that was it.
We lucked out.
Yeah, we lucked out. Thank you for coming, Paul. And this has been a fabulous discussion. I really appreciate it. I think it's so underreported and such a huge issue. It just blows my mind that it's not talked about more.
Well, we used to do a Cascadia Forest Alliance, an offshoot of Earth First, used to do a regular monthly event at the Clinton Street Theater called the Cascadia Forest Review, which was just an amazing event. We always filled the theater, well, almost, and had, media component, speaker, just sort of mingling, and a musical performer. There are so many great singer-songwriters came out of the Earth First movement. Anyway, I'm just kind of throwing it out there. I'd love to see something like that happen again. There was a attempt at it that I think the Rising Tide folks did a few years ago. Maybe the pandemic put a kibosh on that.
Well, I think that's what we're trying to do, too. We're trying to use this as an intervention in the mainstream environmental movement, because if we don't put this front and center, then we're doomed. So I think the integration of militarism in the consciousness of environmentalists, a lot of well-intentioned liberals who just have no idea how much of a contributor the U.S. military is. So it's really hoping to really put that in the forefront and change the narrative here. And I hope that happens.
So let's do some more events at the Clinton Street.
Let's do it.
I guess that's the birth of a new initiative right here on the air, KBOO Community Radio. Well, this has been so great. I really thank you for being on. And what are some of the best ways to find out about the work? There's Earth's Greatest Enemy. There's Empire Files.
There's Empire Files. If you're interested in our other movie, GazaFightsForFreedom.com, I cannot recommend that enough, given what the horrific things are unfolding right now. So check that out, Gaza Fights for Freedom. But yeah, Empire Files is our platform. Check it out. Follow me on social media and reach out to me.
Yeah, I meant to talk more about that Gaza film. But okay, we're out of time. Thanks, Abby.
I'll have to be next time. Thanks, Paul.
Okay. Bye, everybody.
Where we're heading is extremely grim. So we have to brace our